Before we start the show, I want to tell you about Pitchfork Economics with my friend Nick Hanauer. If you think, like me, the economy should be designed to work for everyone and not just the wealthy few, you need to hear this podcast. If you don't know Nick, he's a zillionaire and an unapologetic capitalist, and he's one of the best and loudest voices about economic inequality. He's had amazing people on the show, the most original economic and political thinkers, people like Anand Giridharadas and Pramila Jayapal, Joe Stiglitz and Naomi Klein, and even me. Every week, Nick pulls back the curtain to show how the rich and powerful use their tax cuts, deregulation, and wage suppression to keep things working in their favor. Pitchfork Economics is a convention-busting exploration of who gets what and why in the American economy. You can find it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, without further ado, here is the show.
Can you hear me?
Loretta, this is Abby.
Hi, Abby. Good to meet you.
It's so good to meet you. When you said you'd come on the show, I emailed Gloria Steinem. She had nothing but really lovely things to say about you.
We've gotten a lot of good trouble together over the years.
Good trouble. We're sort of like theming this whole season around the idea of John Lewis's good trouble and good troublemakers.
Cool. I do want to just say something about my bio, and that nothing I've done was ever done by myself. So I want to acknowledge that we lift as we climb. It's never a solo act.
I'm Abigail Disney. Welcome to All Ears, my podcast where I get to go deep with some super smart people. This season, I'm talking to good troublemakers, artists, activists, politicians, and others who aren't afraid to shake up the status quo. We'll talk about their work, how they came to do what they do, and why it's so important in hard times to think big. You can't think about solutions without being a little optimistic. And man, oh man, I think we need some optimism right now. Loretta Ross has been doing the whole good trouble thing all her life. She's been working for 50 years fighting for human rights. Her career is really amazing. For instance, after a lifetime of feminist organizing around Black rights, she helped coin the phrase reproductive justice. And she became friends with an ex-Nazi after helping him leave the Aryan Nations. Lately, she's making headlines as she teaches one of the most popular classes at Smith College. In the class, she says, "Folks, I know you know how to call people out, but what I want you to do is build the skills and the courage to call people in." Take a listen to a graduation speech she gave a couple years ago.
When a lot of different people think many different ideas and they move in the same direction, that's a movement. But when a lot of different people think one idea and they move in the same direction, that's a cult. We are not organizing cults. We are organizing a human rights movement. That's a different task.
Loretta, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to be able to talk to you. I wonder if you can start us off by defining, when you say movement, I mean, what are you describing with that word? What kind of movement are you building?
Well, my first entrance into social justice work was as a feminist, so I was definitely one of the early adopters of the whole feminist framework. But then when I did the anti-Klan work, I joined the civil rights movement, and it was actually an ex-Nazi named Floyd Cochran. Once he left the Aryan Nations, he asked a very poignant question. He said, "Loretta, where's the movement I can join?" And I said, "Well, you can join the civil rights movement." And he said, "You think they're ready for an ex-Nazi?" And I was like, maybe not. <You know? laughs> And I know you're not ready for the women's movement because you don't have a whole lot of good ideas around women. And so I took this question to Reverend Vivian, C.T. Vivian. And he told me, Martin. And he was only the person in our whole circle who could say Martin. Because we all had to say Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., civil rights leader, like it was all one word. He said, Martin never meant to build a civil rights movement. And I looked at him like he lost his mind. He said, no, Martin meant to build a human rights movement. You tell Floyd he can join the human rights movement.
Wow.
And so I've called myself a human rights activist ever since. I'm the part of the women's wing of the human rights movement that works with the racial justice wing of the human rights movement, that works with the environmental justice wing, and so on and so on and so on.
So a movement with many wings. That's beautiful. I'm joining the human rights movement.
Yeah. That way you can keep all your caps on at the same time.
When Loretta teaches young people about activism, she always imparts the most important lesson.
Well, Tony Cade said it best. She said that we need to make the revolution irresistible. And so why would anybody want to come join us if we make them feel worse than before they came? If we're a movement of Debbie Downers, I wouldn't join me. I wouldn't join the movement. But really, where someone who changed my perspective was one of my mentors named Leonard Zeskin. And when I first took this job at the National Anti-Klan Network, later renamed the Center for Democratic Renewal, I was feeling the weight of all these civil rights martyrs on my shoulders. We're reading stories of people who had died in Bombingham, also known as Birmingham, and the people who had died trying to register people to vote or just get a fair deal as a sharecropper. I mean, we were totally immersed in this. And I was working 16, 20-hour days. I had lost my sense of humor. I had lost my joy of life. And Lenny came to me. He said, Loretta, lighten up. He said, fighting Nazis should be fun. It's being a Nazi that sucks.
I love that.
And so that's what I started saying. Party as hard as you work. And it made sense. We're supposed to have joy in fighting hate, not be mad and angry and down because we're fighting hate.
So maybe, Loretta, can you tell us about the class that you're teaching at Smith?
Well, my class at Smith is called White Supremacy in the Age of Trump. Because when I was asked to become a professor, it was at the time that Trump was coming down the golden escalator. And I thought that as an anti-fascist researcher and activist, that this was the time to teach young people, particularly young white people, about fascism and white supremacy. So I easily could have taught reproductive justice. I've co-written 3 books on that. But I wanted to stretch myself and speak to the historical dangerous moment that we're in. And so that's my class. And I embed teaching about calling in practices in that class, because the students need to know that you can't reach and convince everybody to join the human rights movement. But generally, from the 90% who have high degrees of unity and shared worldview to the 75% who have more agreement, for example, I'm an abortion rights activist, but I'll see as a 75% of the Girl Scouts. They may never teach on abortion, but they teach about women and girls empowerment. And outside of them are the 50%ers, like my parents, who believe in family values and love, but were staunchly anti-abortion. But I don't want to leave my parents to be out there to be organized by the 25% when I can appeal to them through family love and shared values. Well, I'll just tell a quick story. My mother used to make us always cook food and serve it to homeless people. And so when my mother was trying to figure out, Loretta, exactly what do you do besides go to jail? She just couldn't understand the career of a social justice human rights activist. I said, well, Mom, do you remember when we had to serve the homeless people when I was a Girl Scout because you thought they were hungry? She said, yes. I said, well, as a social justice activist, I ask why they're hungry in the first place. And my mother got it. I said, we have the same values, Mom. I just chose a different strategy to live out the values you taught me. And we can talk to people using values all the time instead of stereotyping them to the political identities that they're assigned themselves or that we assign to them.
You know, you just described the conversation I had with my mother, exactly that conversation, when she would get angry with me for having very different political positions. I would keep saying, Mom, these are all the things you taught me. We share the same values. And I've worked with people on the right wing a fair amount. And you could get to 50% with a lot of people, surprising amounts of people.
I think so. I think the majority of Trump supporters and I share values, but we have different solutions and strategies for enacting those values. But we all want to keep our family safe, our country safe. We want personal safety for ourselves. I'm not actually going out there and trying to persuade a militia member with an AK-47 that they've got to see me as a human being. I'm going to quite naturally either defend myself or run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't think that's the majority of people who are Trump supporters. I think they're just human beings like us.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that can get you into real trouble with cancel culture, saying that, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I'm seen by my more radical leftist comrades as being too tolerant. But I don't think a member of the human rights movement should dehumanize another human being.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Loretta avoided social media for a long time, as many of us oldsters have. She finally joined Facebook after her then 10-year-old grandson insisted. That's when she discovered cancel culture.
So I got on Facebook and immediately he went off to Instagram or somewhere else. Because he said it was for old fogies.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, kid, but I'm not following you around the internet. And so once I did, though, I noticed how mean people were to each other over social media. It had gone totally beneath my radar because I hadn't been an early adopter. And so when I asked other young people, what's this all about? Why are y'all so mean? This young woman said, oh, you mean the call-out culture? And my first response, y'all have named it? she said, yeah. I said, well, what are you doing about it? And she kind of shrugged like it was a helpless situation. And so I started thinking about it and remembering how we had to deal with trashing when we were young feminists. When I was a Black nationalist activist, the worst burn they could give you is that you're not relevant.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a serious burn.
Ow.
Yeah. Like you were just a dilettante and you don't belong in this conversation. And I thought if in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, feminists could have these very hard conversations with people who weren't necessarily on our BFF list, why are people in the same human rights movement unable to have productive debates with each other without calling each other out?
Do you think that some forms of social media have dragged us down into the mud a little bit?
I don't know, because I'm old enough to remember party lines over the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother thought that the telephone was the devil's instrument because every time you picked up the phone, you could hear the neighbor bad-mouthing another neighbor. So I don't think the behavior is that new. I think that our toys have gotten faster and more widespread, but I don't think the behavior is that new.
It's complicated. And Loretta is the first one to admit that social media is a pretty essential tool to have in the fight that she's fighting.
The human rights movement has as its best tactic shame and blame of individuals and governments that create harm to people, that violate people's human rights. I'm just offering a perspective that we need to know when to turn the fight off, that we just can't use that as an instant automatic reflex every time we think somebody is being harmed or committing a human rights violation. Because the other thing that's important as a human rights activist to remember is intent and outcome. You have to remember that everything someone does to hurt you may not have been on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so you can't act like everything was done on purpose or you don't have accurate threat assessment.
You've used the language of calling in. You know, some of the people we need to work with, as you say, are really hard to love.
Well, a calling in is not that deep. It's a call out done with love and respect. So you still hold the person accountable for the harm that they may have done, or at least your perception that they did harm, because everybody that claims harm actually hasn't been hurt just because you have a debate with them. But you hold people accountable in a way that foregrounds your love and your respect for them versus your anger and disdain. You could either react like, you said this wrong thing, blah, 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 blah. Or you could say, you know, when you used that word a few minutes ago, I'm not sure what you meant by it. Can we go have coffee and talk about it? Those are two separate approaches for dealing with the same contradiction or offense without making people feel like they're being publicly shamed. They go on the defensive. They have to double down on what they said or did because you've attacked their character and morality. I mean, there's a lot of other options we have if we choose not to make the world meaner than it needs to be.
But there are people who say, well, you're just pacifying white fragility. You know, you're just letting the patriarchs get away with it.
I think they're mistaking it for civility lessons. And that is not what it's all about. I think that artificial civility is always being used to cloak injustices. And so that would be the furthest thing I'd ever want to promote or achieve. I'm calling on people to become better human beings. And it's only once you become a better human being and practice some form of self-awareness and responsibility for the consequences of your actions that we can actually successfully build a human rights movement, dealing with our differences as strengths instead of liabilities. For example, the way you call in is to first start with the self-assessment. Are you in a healthy enough healed place from your past trauma in order to extend grace and the benefit of the doubt to another human being? If you're still in that place where you want to respond with anger, then walk away. It's not your job to call people in. It's a choice that you make. And you don't have to be responsible for the fact that someone isn't able to grow at that moment. But after you've done that self-assessment, then you need to think about what outcome do I want to achieve before I take this step? And if the outcome is to keep the person in your movement and help them grow while you grow at the same time, then that's a good reason to call somebody in. But I do need to warn one other thing, though. You can't take responsibility for someone else's inability to accept new information or to accept another perspective. We don't have that God-given power of actually changing other people. Otherwise, we wouldn't have some problems in our marriages and stuff. But you can be proud of the fact that you called on your higher self to offer grace, forgiveness, and awareness to other people. And maybe you planted a seed and you didn't see the instant epiphany, but it may blossom long after you're gone. And so calling in is a practice of accountability to actually help transform how people relate to each other and hold each other accountable. And I'll say one other thing. The other part of learning to call in is self-forgiveness, first of all, but really excavating where those patterns of punishment of others came from. And really ask yourself, is that the way I want to walk through the world? Constantly on the lookout for the next fight so that I can punish them, so that I can make people feel bad and do it behind the pseudo-moralism or pseudo-intellectualism. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's some kind of deep itch that needs scratching when people do this a lot? What are they trying to satisfy in themselves?
I don't know. I mean, they're trolls, so I'm not holding any excuse out for trolls, people who delight in blowing up people's minds because that's the only way they can get some kind of pleasure. But I think there's a lot of people innocently doing it as well because they're revealing some unmet need in their lives, because it, you should think twice before you choose to blow up somebody's life or hold them accountable for something stupid they did as a teenager. It says more about them than the people that they've accused in many ways. And I'm like, why don't you want to put more joy in the world?
Yeah. The question is, where's the line? How much is too much? And are we required to extend love and respect to Donald Trump? When does it become counterproductive to do so?
Well, I think how you do human rights work is as important that you do it. And so while I am very eager to call Donald Trump out for his abuse of office, his constant lying, his profiteering while in office, the shady deals he cuts with dictators, I mean, I don't have time to list all of his faults. At the same time, I would draw the line at terrorizing his family or his children, because that would violate my sense of human rights and dignity. Because that's what the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacists do. They surround somebody's home and make them fear for their safety instead of just keeping to protesting their policies. Yes, there is a time when it can go too far, but I never hesitate to punch upwards when people are violating their responsibilities and causing harm to so many people. I really will criticize anybody who punches downward. But most of the calling out I see in the human rights movement is actually sideways.
Yeah. I think that's when movements are really frustrated, is when they turn on each other, don't you think?
I think so, because we all act like we're in the pursuit of political purity. We're in a woke competition. And I find it's really amusing when young people get taught these radical phrases and these radical analyses, and then they turn around and don't have the radical practices to go with them. So they weaponize their newly found knowledge against each other. We don't use that word anymore. You're being transphobic. You can't get this right. I mean, that kind of thing. And it's distressing, because for the young people in particular, since I teach this stuff to them, they said, we are so tired of walking around on eggshells. We silence ourselves. We censor ourselves because we don't want to be the next person getting bullied.
Yeah. When I was in grad school in the 80s, and there was people like Pat Buchanan and Bill Bennett and others talking about political correctness and how evil it was, and the universities had blah, blah, blah. Do you think that to some small extent the right wing was a little bit right in that regard?
Well, the right wing is rarely right. So I have a different opinion. I think the whole cancellation and call-out culture started with our puritanical roots. I mean, there is a reason we read Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. And long before they invented the term political correctness, we had the right canceling people because they were accused of communism. So it's a bit rich for the right to suddenly accuse the left of inventing a weapon that they wielded when they, because they only started complaining about it as a weapon when we started punching back. They quickly claim victimhood status. And if they lose any, then they've been victimized. Not really. Because they use the scarcity model in how they see the world. A plunder scarcity model, which I actually think is one of the root causes of what's wrong with our society, because we don't believe that there's enough to go around for everybody. And if I gain something as a Black person, then white people must lose something. And that whole zero-sum thinking is what animates the ideology of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. I want to just point out a fact that many people have not noticed. Amongst all the chatter about how the majority of white people voted for Trump, as they have done for every election for the past 50 years, they voted for the Republicans. One fact actually stood out. Young white voters between ages of 18 and 29 broke for Biden. That's the first generation of white people who have broken with the tradition of supporting white supremacy. And wow. I find so much hope in that statistic. It's kind of like First, we got them through our music. Now we just got your kids.
You have them.
Yeah.
I never heard anybody point that out. That's thrilling.
Well, think what it cost them to do so, though, because this is not without sacrifice, because they're going against their cultural brainwashing. They're going against their family and Uncle Frank at the Thanksgiving dinner. They're going against the people on whom they're still financially dependent. It's a very brave thing that they've done. And we need to lift that up and award them for that instead of having it be invisibilized, because I think that's something that as a Black person, we have never seen in 400 years, a break with white supremacy by the upcoming generation who will, in a very short period of time, be the ones in power.
Right. That's thrilling. That actually makes me really happy to think about it. But so to go back to calling out for one second, there's also a level of impracticality to call out culture in terms of growing the movement and moving things forward, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, because if we become the circular firing squad, that oft-used cliche, then we're spending our best bullets on each other while the people who oppose human rights are busily causing havoc and destruction everywhere. Because when you take your eyes off the prize, you really do miss your opportunity to gain power to make the changes that you think are desirable and necessary. As I said, I think that people who abuse power, who punch down on vulnerable people should be called out. But we also need to be clear that this can become such a self-defeating act. I signed a letter in Harper's last summer that criticized the call-out culture. People on the left and the right signed this letter. And then ironically, we got called out for signing a letter criticizing the call-out culture. As if it's totally impossible for people on the right and the left to agree on anything. There are things people on the right and left do agree with. For example, I'm deeply critical of the Patriot Act and its invasion of privacy. And so are many people on the right. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that I should support the Patriot Act because the people on the right don't like it? I mean, that's a little silly, isn't it?
That's deeply silly, is what it is.
They didn't recognize the irony of criticizing a letter calling out the call-out culture, and they chose to call us out for doing it.
Working with her enemies is not some exercise for Loretta. In many ways, it's her life's work. She made a friendship with a former Klansman named Floyd Cochran, and this was so surprising to people that it was nearly made into a movie. And when she ran the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, her work helping rape victims took an unexpected turn.
We received this letter from a guy that said, "Outside, I raped women, and inside, I rape men, and I don't want to be a rapist anymore." And the author of that letter was a guy named William Fuller. And we sat on that letter for months. We didn't immediately respond because our first reaction was, we barely have enough resources to help rape survivors. And here's a perpetrator asking us for help? I don't think so. But eventually we responded, and I remember getting in my car and driving that 20 miles every Friday to Lorton Reformatory. And I met William and Larry and other men, and they were the bosses of that jail. They were all buffed up and muscular because that's how they got power and terrorized younger and weaker people. And so they were quite intimidating physically, but they were sincere. William was in his mid-30s when I first met him, so he'd had time to reanalyze his life. He taught himself how to read and really rehabilitated himself. And somehow he got hold of some Black feminist literature. I don't know how that happened, but that was the framework through which he wrote us at the Rape Crisis Center. As they told me their stories about being victims of rape and rapists themselves, and then I started sharing my story about surviving sexual assault, that I wasn't afraid of them anymore. At 11 years old, I was kidnapped and taken to the woods and raped.
She had been at an amusement park with her Girl Scout troop. Afterward, The man who raped her dropped her back home. She never told her mom.
I was afraid that I'd get in trouble because a lot of rape victims self-blame first, right?
Yeah.
And it was only my sister, who's 9 years older than me, that noticed that I was bruised and bloody. And so 3 years later, an older cousin was getting me drunk and having sex with me because that was the way he manufactured consent. And so I was pregnant at 14. It was very common in the 60s to stick girls into homes for unwed mothers. And our, you know, the task was to have the baby in secret, give the baby up for adoption, then return to your life as if you'd just been on an extended vacation. But I gave birth at a Catholic hospital, and I still don't know whether this was a mistake or not, or they did it on purpose, because the morning after my son was born, they brought him to me. And I looked at this little face, and I kept saying, "He's got my face. He's got my face. He's got my face." And I didn't believe in mother love until that moment. That was not the way I wanted to become a mother. I hadn't planned on becoming a mother. I was a pregnant teenager. But when I made the decision to keep him, everything changed. Everything changed. And so the school didn't want to readmit me because, as the counselor told me, "Well, Loretta, if we let you in, other girls might get pregnant."
Yeah,
I don't know about much about biology, but that's not how it works.
She had an early scholarship to Radcliffe College, but they withdrew her admission. Luckily, Howard University didn't, and they offered her a full ride.
They didn't care that I'd had a baby. They just looked at my NMSQT scores and said, "Yeah, we want you." But I'll just shorten the story by saying that it was at Howard University that I first got tear gassed at 16. But I still didn't even become an activist then. It wasn't until I was sterilized at age 23 by the Dalkon Shield and a doctor.
Wait, what? Go back. Okay. What?
Oh, you want the long version.
Okay. You can't just drop "I was sterilized" into a conversation without expecting to give me the longer story.
Well, when I was leaving for college, I asked my mother if she would sign permission for me to have birth control. And being the Christian woman, she said no. So I fell in love with my first boyfriend in college, and we had sex 3 times, and I became pregnant. I was Fertile Myrtle back then. <You know? laughs> And so, fortunately, D.C. legalized abortion 3 years before Roe v. Wade. Mm. And so I was able to go to the Washington Hospital Center, have a perfectly legal abortion. My older sister, who's 9 years older than me, forged my mother's signature so I could have the abortion. So after the abortion, Howard University was offering the Dalkon Shield. And I thought that was the answer to my prayers.
But the Dalkon Shield was not the answer to Loretta's prayers. It was a defective device that caused injury and infertility to many of the 2.5 million women who used it in the early 1970s. And like many Black women, Loretta didn't receive adequate medical care.
After about 4 years of having the Dalkon Shield in me, my fallopian tubes exploded. And so that's what led to the hysterectomy. While I was unconscious, because I had passed out all the way to the hospital in an ambulance, there were massive studies already at that time showing its danger because of a design flaw. Back then, you could actually get copies of your medical records upon request. And so I got a copy of my medical records. So I sued A.H. Robbins and bought my first house with the proceeds.
That's not exactly making up for it, but
right. At 23, I was told I wouldn't have any more children. And compounded with all the other traumas I'd had in my life, I was suicidal, self-destructive, drug dependent. I mean, I'm ashamed of all the things I did to survive and try to self-manage my own trauma. And it wasn't until 4 years later that I finally took my own advice that I was giving to all the rape survivors at the Rape Crisis Center and finally checked into some therapy. And that's why I'm here today.
Wow. Wow. But how amazing, because your rest of your life has been so positive and loving and gracious. I guess the last thing I want to ask you is, where do you go to refill what seems like a bottomless well of joy and gratitude? Where do you go to refill yourself?
Well, I have two particular things that I do. First of all, I have a Black feminist posse. And we have Friday night cocktail parties virtually so that we can stay connected to each other. And I call them my source of replenishment. But the second one is that I have a totally apolitical set of senior citizens that I play competitive pinochle with, which is a card game. And they, while I'm protesting wars, they're doing yellow ribbon parties. So they don't understand anything about my politics, but I love them to death. So they keep me balanced so that I'm not just in a left-wing bubble of people who all think like me.
Ah, I love that so much. If I knew how to play pinochle, I'd ask you to invite me to play.
Are you in California?
Well, I'm based in New York City.
Oh, okay. Because if you're in California, I can say I understand that Dionne Warwick and Gladys Knight have a pinochle club down there.
Oh, my God. I'm going to learn how to play pinochle tonight. Sounds like the funnest thing ever.
Before COVID, we had competitive tournaments all over America.
Wow.
But now we just all play online.
Oh, how fun. I'm so happy we got a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you're so welcome. For links to Loretta Ross's writings and more information about her very extensive work in social justice, organizing, and reproductive justice, visit LorettaRoss.com. And don't forget to follow her on Twitter at Loretta J. Ross. All Ears is a production of Fork Films. The show was produced by Alexis Pancrazzi and Christine Schomer. Lauren Wimbush is our associate producer. Sabrina Yates is our production coordinator. Our engineer is Veronica Rodriguez. Bob Golden composed our theme music. Additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. The podcast team also includes VP of Production, Aideen Kane. Our executive producer is Kathleen Hughes. Learn more about the podcast on our website, forkfilms.com. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review All Ears wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.